Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Fred. I am responsible. I am accountable. I am capable of assisting people to find their true voice and then deliver it effectively into the world around us. With 40 years in mental health, 32 of them as a psychiatrist, and then a massive amount of conversations, including podcasting and expert speaking, keynote speaking, I have the opportunity to really see the magic that it takes to find one's authentic self and then deliver it effectively into the world. And if you're like me, you can see that now more than ever, that's what's called for. So today is that day. Now is that time. Come forth. Join me in the broadcast. You'll see on the other side of this at True Voice with Dr. Fred. Damn, how you doing?
Dr. Fred Muss. What's going on, bro? Buddy?
How you good, doing? Man.
All right.
Going through another day, doing what I can to, you know, walk tall and carry a what did he say? Walk tall and carry a
kind heavy of stick.
Heavy yeah. stick.
All right. So I don't know. There's some phrase kind of like that. There's something around carrying a heavy stick, carrying a big stick.
Walk tall and carry a big stick. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like it.
Kicking ass and taking names.
Yeah. I don't even know. Do people even walk tall and carry big sticks? Have you ever seen anyone doing that?
You know, maybe every once in a while, but it's usually someone hiking and it's hiking. Not particularly threatening, you know?
Right.
And it's like about the least threatening people that I can imagine, you know?
Right. They're the ones who are carrying a big stick.
Yeah. Like a big hiking stick from REI or something like that.
Right.
You know, those are the least threatening hikers. When you see a hiker who's actually carrying a hiking stick, you know, that
right.
they've bought REI or LL Bean or something like that, you know that they are going to be your least threatening hikers out there.
Right. I think you're right.
If you believe that you require something to stabilize yourself while you're taking a walk, you pretty much can sure that those people are not going to be a threat. Even with
I see.
Those,
so, you know, who do you think said this thing?
Well, maybe we should do a little research.
I'm doing it right now. I am already here.
Oh, okay. All right. Wow, aren't you something?
Take a stab.
Yeah. Walk tall and carry a big stick. Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right. Exactly. And what would you say is what might be the etiology?
Was I actually correct? That was right?
That is correct.
Really? No shit. Ding, ding, ding. Jeopardy winner today.
Oh, yeah, big shit. Jeopardy winner. Well, you didn't say who is Teddy
who
Roosevelt.
Who is? And what did he say in reference to?
Yeah. Roosevelt described his style of foreign policy as the exercise of intelligent forethought and of decisive action sufficiently far in advance of any likely crisis.
Yeah,
as practiced by Roosevelt, big stick diplomacy had five components. First, it was essential to possess serious military capability that would force the adversary to pay close attention. At the time, that meant a world-class navy, and Roosevelt never had a large army at his disposal. The other qualities were to act justly towards other nations, never to bluff, to strike only when prepared to strike hard, and to be willing to allow the adversary to save face and defeat.
Allow the adversary to save face and defeat.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Only strike hard, allow the adversary to save face and defeat. Act justly towards other nations and never to bluff.
You know, it's interesting because it seems to me that these types of, say, philosophical constructs that are based in sort of noble principles, you could look at it as the U.S.'s own version of the art of war, perhaps. You know, it seems to me there used to be more of some philosophical underpinnings that were behind the use of force in military action. And it seems like we've kind of thrown those out the door instead of, you know, it's kind of like, well, if they threaten the bottom line and they are, and there's an opportunity for the expansion of the military industrial complex and the Pentagon's budget, then yeah, let's just kick their ass.
It's kind of let's just go for it.
Let's just go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. If we get an opportunity that goal, then why not just jump right in?
Mm-hmm.
If it fits the budget and it allows us to expand our complex,
mm-hmm.
may leave a hole open for us to do it,
mm-hmm.
then there's no good reason not to proceed. That's like the new philosophy.
Let me, on along these lines, let me ask you a question. It's sort of a, maybe a moral dilemma. Artificial intelligence robots in the military, yes or no?
Well, what are they going to be? You're going to make rules that say they can't be there or something?
Right. I mean, I mean, it's doubtful that, especially with the advancements of these technologies, that there would be any kind of rules that these were not going to be. I mean, it's pretty much inevitable that this type.
Here's what I say about the whole thing. It would be it's a yes, but it's yes only in that any kind of ground war is a distraction at this point. It's not really where the war is being fought. So whether or not soldiers kill soldiers or robots kill soldiers or robots deactivate robots has nothing to do with where the war is really taking place anyways. Mm-hmm. It's just a visual for the general public to think that that's where the combat zone is. But the combat zone isn't being fought in an entirely different realm.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
It had nothing to do with how many people are dying in Ukraine or Russia. That's not where the war is. There's a war that's going on that's way bigger than that one.
Yeah. So let's talk about the different, if you want, we could explore that and talk about the different sort of dimensions in which that war is happening, not necessarily metaphysical dimensions. Oh, by the way, if you want to call in and chat with us about AI, robots, and war, anything else for that matter, 888-627-6008 is the number, 888-627-6008. Give us a call and tell us your thoughts about AI, robots.
Yeah, TJ, if the phone line's back up again and you need to hire extra operators, just let us know. We'll pick up the bill for that one.
Yeah, so what do you think about all the different arenas in which this war is being fought? I mean, are we, what arenas are you aware of these days that you know, are worth discussing?
Yeah. Well, it seems like in the economic arena, there's shit happening that's so far above my head that I don't even get. I have no idea how the dollar is remaining the gold standard, for instance, when it's just a piece of shit. I mean, it's just literally a piece of shit that's being created any given time that anyone wants to turn on the fucking machine. And that somehow that addresses or creates the world economy. It seems like there's something going on there that has to be one of the linchpins for which a war is, being activated, is at least in the economies, the world global economy. And, you know, because inflation and gross national products and, you know, the profit of multinational corporations and, you know, this idea that China is at war with us. I think there might be a Chinese-American war that's already underway that we citizens are not even aware of. And that it might be a war for which more casualties are being created than any of the previous wars, but not measured by people who are shot with a gun or hit with a bullet or a cannonball, but instead by people whose lives are being devastated and countries whose infrastructure is being, what's it called? Like deconstructed, you know, like, I feel like there's like that's going on at a level that we, yeah, destabilize. There you go. You know, but that's going on at a level that neither me or you are, can be made aware of, nor should we be. I mean, we're fucking around trying to figure out how to put our, you know, how to put our clothes on right and which drink to have next.
Yeah, I was wondering which bathroom I should go in today. And I think that was the big thing that was really, you know, and I got stuck outside both bathrooms and
Chased two rabbits and caught none.
Well, I was kind of hitting my head against the wall because, you know, I have been going down this sort of Zen Buddhist rabbit hole for a long time here. And I suddenly realized that if it really all came down to it, I don't even exist. And so how could it be either a man or a female or an other? And so I just kind of sat there in paralysis outside of the bathrooms and peed myself.
I see. So which are the two public rooms, men versus women?
Yeah. And if I transcended identity, it meant I couldn't go into any of the bathrooms. So I just pissed myself in the hallway.
Nice.
Yeah.
Seems like that's the right answer.
Seems like it's the way to go.
Yeah. I think it's what I would have done. You know, if you're a transcender of transgender, then you got to actually pitch yourself in the hallway.
Yes. I love this new phrase, transcender of transgender.
Yeah. I think if you run into that particular dilemma, you're stuck pissing wherever you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I a man? Am I a woman? Am I even identified? Do they have a they, you know, what do they have, a they restroom?
Yeah. And I call my genitals my penina.
Your penina.
Penina. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I told you in medical school the people who taught I guess it would be genitourinary or whatever. They called it a penis.
A penis, did they? Yeah. 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 Interesting.
That's the name of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The people in the know do not call that thing a penis. They call it a penis.
That's the more sort of classy and sophisticated way of referring to the.
Well, every so often I'd show up in class. I'd show up in class for some reason. And if I heard the professor say the word penis, I just would walk out.
Be like, dude, did they refer to things like penile dysfunction as well?
Yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. Really, the word is penis. If you look it up in the medical word dictionary, it's not penis, it's penis.
Yeah. But only the doctors know that because they have to be a class above and in the strata above the rest of the lay class.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking a lot about doctors today.
Yeah, tell me.
I don't know if you saw my most recent post, but I'm kind of, you know, this idea of me being a doctor. I am Dr. Fred after all, and I'm the undoctor and all those things. And I was a psychiatrist. I'm a psychiatrist right now, and I got an MD and all that. So that makes me a doctor. But I am really at times just so, you know, so turned off by what it means to be an allopathic doctor and the lies and the corruption that's involved in that. This idea that it's the number one most respected field gets driven home every so often, you know, like the number one most respected field in all the country is being a doctor. And I think once they drive home that fact, that all that does is create the populace to understand that they should respect doctors because everyone does. And the truth is that doctors and the whole medical field is not naturally respectable in any way. It's created on a ton of myths and you know, myths, M-Y-T-H-S. And it really is ready to be dissembled.
I'd be curious to dive into this topic of respect in general and what it is that generates this sort of stratified
layering of respect within our society, why it is that certain individuals within certain professions seem to garner more respect culturally, and why in which that seems to be sort of this unspoken agreement. Of course, there are any number of ways in which, any number of implications to that too, especially with regards to if you're receiving information from someone who you hold in respect and as an authority figure, it's much more likely to bypass the filter of your own subjective criteria and beliefs and go straight into the subconscious in the brain and turn into a hardwired belief without proper examination. But what is it that you feel is behind this whole existential respect thing, and why certain individuals and certain people with certain statuses or jobs seem to command more respect in our culture, such as doctors, such as, well, I guess maybe not as much as it used to be, but priests and pastors and et cetera.
Yeah, are three good ones. I think that you have a algorithm that you created there, which is, what is this respect thing in the first place? You know, like, why respect anything or anyone? Why respect anyone more than another person? What is it about a person that has you think that you have the right to respect them more or less than another person? And why that's a good idea, whatever that means. In other words, call them more worthy or listen to them with more, more faith that what they represent is truth. Like, what is respect? Is it, it's not just Aretha Franklin. She's got plenty to say about it, of course. But, you know, and who is Aretha Franklin when she's demanding it? Is it the little she? Is it, you know, you bring me some respect. It's like, who is this me she's talking about that is demanding respect? It's the woman. It's the woman with the goods, the woman with the sex, the woman with the food. What is it? It's like, you know, at all levels, you continue to respect me. That's what, you know, and she holds it as in that song, certainly as maybe the number one criteria of what he's supposed to do when he comes home. You know, and I really do wonder, why would I think, I mean, I would say that I literally respect you more than, I don't even know anyone I respect more than you. And it's true. And I think the proper answer to that would be like, thank you, as if you deserve the respect that I'm providing to you. You know, that somehow I'm giving you credit for earning some additional respect from me. And if I tell you that, then somehow you might think that I'm giving you a gift or complimenting you or saying something good or, you know, requiring you to receive with gratitude the idea that I respect you more than anyone I know, which is true, by the way. If someone asked me, who do I respect most on the planet, you would be on that short list for sure.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm just looking at the definition here on something, some etymology website. It says to regard, to notice with special attention, to look back, Latin, or look back, delay, from the Latin respectare. To look back at, regard, consider, to treat with deferential esteem, regard with some degree of reverence, is from the 1550s. Refrain from injuring or interfering with is from the 1620s. It's really interesting when you consider this, because that what a interesting word that creates a whole psychological orientation around self and other. Like, when you say that you respect me, that is something that I assume is a byproduct of a
frame of reference that you've developed in me and seeing my actions and my behaviors and my thoughts and my feelings being aligned or integrated with sort of higher principles. Maybe it's partly.
Dude, future. I wouldn't go that far. Slow down. Slow the fuck down. Don't get all retarded about it. All I said is that I respect you more than other people. I didn't say all this other shit.
So go ahead. But yeah, so when we're talking about respecting a doctor, there's this sort of esteem that doctors tend to be granted that may or may not be an earned esteem. I think
usually not.
And I think that there's, so it's interesting.
People think they earned it. People give doctor that respect because they think they earned it during the 8 years that they were in college. They think that that's when it got branded on them.
Right. And there's this assumption that somehow that amount of time of studying and acquiring information, much of which has been proven ineffective or inaccurate to begin with.
Always has been irrelevant and impertinent, by the way, long before it was proven inaccurate. Right. It was always impertinent and irrelevant.
Right. And somehow the ability to retain that information long enough to regurgitate it in some sort of tests and so forth in order to graduate with an MD behind your name and call yourself a doctor, you don't necessarily have to have actually helped anyone in any kind of substantive way whatsoever.
That's
to
for sure.
Have already acquired that degree of respect. It's almost like this, it seems as though, unlike any other profession, in the medical world, it's supposed to be kind of this secret knowledge almost, that only someone who has studied medicine is able to acquire this sort of secret knowledge. It's almost like we attribute some sort of magical skill that is a rare type of human being can possess this particular type of knowledge, and that they are the alchemists, they are the wizards who are able to help society and who have chosen to commit their lives to the betterment of the world. Not to disrespect any potential doctor or anyone who might happen to be listening to this. Hey, we're all worthy of respect, and there's plenty of awesome doctors out there. So this is about the profession, not the individual. This is about the term and how it naturally creates this feeling of, oh, I respect that guy's a doctor. This guy's an MD.
Right.
It's like you're,
right.
It makes you almost, well, not almost, it makes certainly a lot of people, maybe even the majority of people, stop what they're doing and listen and go, okay, well, I should probably listen to this person because they probably know better than I do because they possess the magical knowledge that they went to the magical knowledge school for.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, would someone have that same type of appreciation for someone who is in another, maybe more technical field that required just as much knowledge, but maybe did not have the sort of connotations of being a savior of humanity kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't think that people do get that level of respect. You know, I know that if I dangle my MD out there in any crowd whatsoever, if I tell people that I'm a doctor, I get a newfound and instant respect from the people in the room. Mm-hmm. They're actually curious about what I think about almost anything. Mm-hmm. And give me an extra edge and probably having something important to say.
Maybe even a free back rub in certain circles.
Certain circles, I can get a free back rub. Yeah. Or I can, and there's other situations where, you know, I can come forth. Without hesitation. Yeah.
So there's this okay, so I want to back this up and look at this because I like looking at why human beings tend to collectively
absorb. You know, this happens a lot. This happens a lot with superstars. You know, other sure. people that it happens, like, you know, Anthony Fauci certainly picked up a fair amount of respect mm-hmm. just by being Anthony Fauci. Or at the same time, the counterbalancing disrespect that he also received. Uh-huh. And then some of our athlete, you know, super athletes, they get a certain respect, like, you know, like iconic, reverence, you know, mm-hmm. Like, am I interested in really, in, do I really care what Seth Curry has to say about anything political? The answer is no, I don't give a shit really. But if he says something political, I'm going to listen. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there's like a bona fide attachment to that little self of the person, deserving more attention than the average person gets. It's kind right. of a twisted illusion, totally. It's kind of a thoroughly twisted illusion.
Yeah, and that's what I'm kind of trying to dig down into a little bit here so that we can kind of look at some of the underpinnings of this this term and why it is that certain people, and of course there's earned respect and unearned respect, which is a whole other domain that we could explore. And a lot of what we're talking about right now is unearned respect, especially when it comes to being in a certain profession and then being highly regarded as someone who can speak with any kind of expertise on a subject that's out of their domain of expertise. But there's this insidious way in which this notion of respect undermines one's ability to actually do their own analysis yeah. of any given person or situation. If yep. I am so taken by a political figure or a celebrity or whatever, and I have there's something about that character, maybe it's their charisma or maybe it's their boldness or their hard work or whatever, their education, that has generated that feeling of respect in me, I am less likely to do the due diligence of actually checking in with what they're talking about and who they're being than I would with your average person. They bypass a certain filter of consciousness as a result of their of the privilege that they've earned within my brain. And that's yeah. true for everyone. And I think that there's a lot to be said about the way in which that creates this viral-like programming that happens at an unconscious level and gets passed from person to person and creates a tribal groupthink around certain figures, well-known figures.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I wonder what it really does to those figures too, because I know when I receive more respect than I think I deserve, I can feel it when a room is giving me all sorts of credit for being funny or being interesting or being smart or something like that. And I feel respect churning. It allows me, my head to grow, and I start thinking that I start believing that what I'm about to say must be interesting too. And another thing is that I think the bar gets lowered. For instance, with Deepak Chopra or Jordan Peterson or, Oprah Winfrey or Joe Dispenza or something like that. If these people say something, these people of high virtue say something, they have a lower bar. They're allowed to say something much more vague and get credit for it being brilliant. You know, they don't have to be entirely precise.
Absolutely. In fact, all Jordan Peterson needs to do is obfuscate his communication enough that he has lost half of his audience in order to get their respect, because they simply don't understand what the hell he said. And so they assume it must be interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
But you just mentioned four perfect figures for this.
Peterson, yeah. Oprah, Dispenza, and Chopra, all of whom I think stand on a pedestal culturally where not only is the bar actually lowered to be able to maintain and sustain a healthy level of respect that doesn't just go to their heads and get perpetuated through their followers. But in addition to that, I think each one of those individuals, with all due respect, has a certain has a certain amount of messianic complex.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we're really talking about here. Let's come back and talk about God and respect and messianic complex, because I think we're at a really beautiful turn here. TJ, why don't you take us out to commercial?
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Fred again. I wanted to explain to you a little bit about one of the names I have called the Undoctor. What is the Undoctor? Well, after about 15 years in the field of me being misaligned with what I was doing, because I was medicating people even knowing that medications were not the right answer, and I was diagnosing people even though I didn't always believe that they had the diagnosis that I said that they had, even though they did meet the criteria, etc., I like seeing humans for exactly who they are and who they're not, and not as a diagnosis. So in 2006, I began the process of becoming the Undoctor. I unmedicated, undiagnosed, and then undoctrinated a bunch of people. Like, people no longer had to come to a psychiatrist because their condition's cleared. This isn't true for everyone. It may not be true for you, but for some folks who know that their diagnosis doesn't fit and who know that they don't want to keep going through with medications and don't want to be seen as someone who's defective or afflicted, this turned out to be a great intervention. Over time, I stopped doing that, and I no longer do a whole lot of conventional psychiatry. Now I just help people walk through their life and find their true voice. I connect with people straight up, not as if there's a power gradient between a doctor and a patient, but as two humans connecting and resonating with each other. As it turns out, that's where all healing emanates from. So today, I've developed the Welcome to Humanity brand over the last 6 or 7 years, and that really takes into consideration all of this. It is self-explanatory. Basically, each and every experience that we have with humanity is just as exquisite as another, even if it's deeply uncomfortable. From there, we get to actually share these human experiences. From there, we get to resonate and connect, and from there, healing takes place. I also have been helping people with their true voice, and that's why you're here today at True Voice with Dr. Frey. I help people find that true voice, really their authentic self, their core value system, and then deliver it effectively into a world that is eagerly awaiting to hear you. Without your voice, no one will ever hear you. And without your true voice, no one will ever know you. But with your true voice, you can find healing, peace, and love. True voice is what it takes to end all wars. So, welcome to True Voice with Dr. Fred.
Yeah, so what was the phrase that you were just speaking to that was like God-like or it had me
messianic say that? Complex.
Yeah, this idea that somehow you're carrying the load for all of humanity and what you have to say actually is worth the weight that people are giving you credit for carrying. You know? Yeah. So there's a big group of people that swear that are just Dispenza-sites, you know, Dispenza-ites. Yep. He's got a remarkable following of really beautiful people.
Huge.
Ridiculous.
And same with Peterson, you know. Same with Chopra. They've all got huge followings.
And Oprah. Oprah too.
And Oprah as well. Oprah, massive, massive following. Now, Oprah, I feel the difference in Oprah is, and I might be wrong because I don't know her content well, but I feel as though she doesn't really, she refrains from espousing a lot of opinions that can become sort of viral or new ways of thinking that are supposed to be the game-changing way of thinking. Whereas Peterson, Chopra, Dispenza are all in the game of getting you to believe their way of perceiving the world, which is traditionally the sort of thing that priests and cult figures and that sort of thing do. And they've, of course, all been accused of these types of things in the past, and maybe for good reason. And I also have a tremendous amount of sympathy for that, too, because what does that... When one, I was thinking about this with respect to Peterson just a day or two ago, when one is put in a position where it seems like on some kind of metaphysical level, you've been chosen as the spokesperson for a certain type of theme, how does that not lead to some type of God complex with respect to being the one, being the messenger?
You know, Sam, you're the closest. In some ways, you are experiencing some version of that in 2.0. You know, you are that in a lot of group people's minds. You are that with someone who's paralyzed, or someone who is the Zen warrior, or you have you're clearly well thought out in many different areas. You're a survivor. You're a doer. You're a miracle. And people do look to you even with some degree of messianic complex. Have you ever thought of that? I think even more than most of our friends that you maintain that position. Whether I think you can almost ask your inner self to answer the question you just posed. Because let's be honest about it. You actually do maintain that role among a bunch of people who otherwise are pretty self-respecting and pretty well achieved in the world and don't really need another, need another Messiah.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly, the thought has crossed my head, that there's, that I am in a relatively rare, position, with respect to, there's the word again, with respect to having a certain type of attention granted to me as a result of how I've lived, what I've been through, et cetera. And I do see it as an enormous responsibility, one that sometimes I feel that, frankly, I'm incapable of living up to. And that's something that I contend with on a daily basis. What actually am I able to live up to? And a lot of that is really trying to let go of ideas or say sort of memes that I think are, truisms without really examining where they're coming from. I think one way of working with this is I've been trying more and more to bring things back into first person perspective so as to speak of things that I might believe to be truisms in a way that I'm not sort of imposing my own opinions unwittingly on someone else, when that might not actually be what they need to hear in the moment. And part of the Zen component of what I'm doing is actually harnessing my own attention enough to be present enough to actually be paying attention to, is this the right thing to say in this moment with given this situation? because what one person might need to hear might be entirely different from what someone else needs to hear. I was just reviewing my speaker reel just a couple of days ago. I've got this new reel that just came out, and I'm very happy with how it came out. And I'm talking about letting go of your circumstances and having the ability that I believe that success is the ability to adapt and move with any given situation as it's occurring without letting those circumstances define your experience, and move in an intentional direction without fear, without being restricted by the past or afraid of the future. Now, to some people, that message is very powerful and empowering. Some people might listen to that message and feel as though I'm talking about spiritual bypass or some type of positive thinking that is in denial of their trauma or whatever that is. I don't know. I don't know how the message reaches people. I guess I can only be responsible for showing up in as much of a integrated fashion with an open mind and trying not to impose ideas so much as share experience.
Yeah, I think when we talked about this before, that when you try to attach a descriptive using simple linguistic, you give yourself such a handicap in the first place, rather than just being that which you say you're being. You think you're describing who you are in this case, or how you think, or how you should be. But in fact, you're using words to do it, which have no capacity to reach out far enough to describe, to actually define the idea that you're doing your best to send, you know, to send to the other person.
Right.
So just by, just by using words, you're limiting any possible value of what you're saying.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think there's so much to be said for that. And if I were to you know, provide a critique with, say, Jordan Peterson, for example, there are certainly times when I'm listening to him, and there's things that he says that I understand and give credence to and so forth. I think he's clearly a smart guy. There's times that he's communicating about things in a way that is maybe lofty intellectually and capable of a high degree of analysis on an intellectual level that could prove some sort of intellectual point that would be hard to argue. But the manner with which he is speaking of these things shows agitation, or I can feel a certain amount of wounding that is being projected onto the topic in addition to the message itself. So there's the layer of the intellectual discourse, and then the human being and the behaviors that I see that underlie the communication that are simultaneously being communicated. There's the verbal, and then there's the energetic. And I always am intrigued when there's a clash between what I feel is being communicated verbally and what I feel the individual is communicating energetically, which I know you've spent decades in your career looking at what someone is communicating verbally and what they're communicating energetically, and where is there an alignment, and where is it out of alignment?
Yeah. Yeah. Even as we speak, I have a coaching client who's a 27-year-old who's whose father is very sick and tired of him and is unwilling to get how sick and tired he is of him. And every so often, their intercourse, their discourse is very affected by the father not being open to anything left for the son to say that's worthwhile. So the son has to reach for completely absurd, wild things to say in order to engage his dad. And it's very sad. And it's actually going on right this very moment, over the top of this particular, podcast. And, what the child is saying is, Dad, please love me and interact with me. What the child, the 27-year-old child is saying is, can you see me? Can you see the real me? You know? And what the dad is saying is, no, I see you as, you know, psychotic or perseverant or whatever.
I'm curious if they or you have read Gabor Mate's recent book, The Myth of Normal.
No.
Yeah, that's a very, it's, that might be a good one to suggest to dad that he check out.
Yeah.
The Myth of Normal is very good. It's, I find Gabor Mate to be offering one of the most compassionate critiques of modern civilization and the problems that we have adopted from the culture at large and the programs and how dysfunctional those ways of thinking are inherently, not even with any kind of real trauma per se, but simply as a byproduct of being alive in the modern world, that there, a certain amount of trauma comes with that experience. And it's a very deeply compassionate, insightful, and scientifically valid book.
Yeah.
Dad might like that.
Yeah, it's a sad situation because what dad really wants me to do is just confirm her son's psychosis and then become the lynchman to throw his son into a homeless shelter or a psych hospital or medicate him. Or so dad's spending all his time now trying to prove to me that his son is the sick one and it's not, has anything to do with the dance that they're in.
Oh, geez.
When it has everything to do with the dance they're in.
Oh, geez. That's an interesting one to take on. So you have years of experience with this, obviously, but something that I'm, that a natural question that emerges from this is, do you have anything specific, any practices in your life related to not taking on some of the dysfunctional energy that you are exposed to with dynamics like that?
Not taking it on.
That's heavy shit. You,
like not taking, taking it on as part of me.
And, yeah. Like not taking it on and being, you know, is the, at the very least perseverating around it or ruminating or just feeling this sort of burden that follows you around potentially. You know, I mean, there's a good sort of reason to cleanse oneself on a regular basis from the types of people that we occupy our time with, especially when there is some type of engagement that we have with them where we shoulder a bit of the responsibility for trying to be the bridge between them and their well-being.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that as a doctor, you know, we've talked about this a couple times, maybe not too often on this podcast for our regular listeners who are familiar with everything we've ever said, you know, when you see 30,000 suicidal patients, there's some sort of armor that gets set up. There's some sort of capacity not to take it in all the way of, as a mandate for even survival. So I don't know if it creates some degree of callous, but the truth is that I really would love to help the dad and the son in this case and have done some major work to do so. You know, I set up the son with a trainer yesterday and the trainer told me it was one of the coolest sessions he'd ever had. And dad doesn't even really realize or isn't giving the son credit for that. And dad had a reasonable conversation with the son earlier today and a reasonable one yesterday. And dad doesn't see any of those positive values. You only see those as what happens in between the real stuff, which is the negative shit. You know, like the positive values are just space fillers rather than the other way around.
Right. It seems like the dad has a bias that he's already assumed, where he almost wants things to go poorly versus positively to reaffirm his existing belief.
Exactly. And he has, it's very difficult to get that point across to him, of course, because once I say anything like that, he's immediately insulted.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow. Good on
it. Is a tough case. Yep.
You've earned my respect.
Yeah. No. It's interesting. You know, we start looking at what is it like, what did I agree to take on when I took on a case like this? You know, who, you know, fighting dad, you know, like yesterday it was like, he wanted to send him to the homeless shelter, but he didn't want to do it. He wanted me to do it. And I'm like, are you ready? And he says, well, if I do that, then we won't need you anymore. You're going to refund the rest of the money I spent for the next several months. And like, dude, no.
Not how it works.
No. I'm going to be right here in the middle, dealing with him and dealing with the shrapnel that you're dealing with. He goes, well, I didn't hire you for me. I hired you for him. I'm like, no, you hired me for the whole system. But he doesn't even see that he is the system.
Wow.
So he's pretty stuck.
Wow.
He's pretty sure that he's done everything. And he's pretty sure that he's very evolved and that he's already thought of everything 1,000 times and all that.
I have compassion for the dad, where he feels that he's at the end of his rope and he is out of options, and he's come to that foregone conclusion that this is it, and he just needs to make some type of radical change. I can only imagine the vulnerabilities which he's unable to express that are inside as a result of harboring that foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Anyone else want to give us a call? 888-627-6008. The phones are flying off the, what is the term? The phones
flying off the hook.
Off the hook.
Yeah.
Remember when phones used to have a hook? Wasn't too long ago. Phones and the hook. Tell me about your first telephone, Fred.
It was
crank dial, yeah.
No, not crank dial. It was a regular dial. It was a handheld phone, and it was my parents bought it for me. I think it was green. And
was this the era where you still had to talk to the operator when you were trying to connect to someone?
No, not quite that either. No, yeah. But I had to go into the party line, and there was a party line that I had. So I had to dial out of the party line to get a private call, or I could have a call inside the party line. There was like a little chat room of people who had the same node, I guess. And so we could actually talk to each other without dialing each other.
What? I never even heard of this shit.
Yeah, party line.
Special Detroit technology or what?
No. If you look it up, it was all over the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
Never knew. Wow.
Yeah.
I remember racking up tons of high phone bills for talking long distance to my girlfriend in the sixth grade who lived about 20 miles away. And that was long enough distance that I would we'd have these astronomical bills at the end of the month. And I would get myself in plenty of trouble as a result. It's funny thinking of how much has changed since then. First videotape, VHS or Betamax, Fred?
Yeah, I had my first videotape was VHS.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what it was?
No, it was some movie. Early on, it was Woodstock. I had Woodstock in there early on.
Okay.
Woodstock.
First concert.
Definitely Jethro Tull.
Jethro Tull, what year?
1973.
73. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then yes was my second one.
Ah, yes. Nice. You ever see ELO?
I did never see ELO.
Okay. Steely Dan?
I never saw Steely Dan because they weren't a touring band. I would have seen them, but they didn't tour for back then.
They didn't tour. They're just a studio band. That's right.
Straight
That's
right. Studio band.
Weather Report?
I saw Weather Report as a backup once for someone. Tower of Power or something.
They have Jocko?
No.
No Jocko. Return to Forever?
Never saw them either.
Herbie Hancock?
I did see Herbie Hancock and certainly have listened to The Police, and I have seen Sting individually as well. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we're reaching the end of our time here.
Oh, I figured this is just a good way to run it out the time.
It is a good way to run it out. I saw Jay Giles. I saw Jay Giles a lot.
Jay Giles, nice.
Jay Giles showed up a lot.
Okay.
And I saw Edgar Winter Band and Johnny Winter Band, and I saw a lot of concerts for sure.
Billy Joel?
I've seen Billy Joel even recently.
Really?
Not so long ago, like 5 years ago, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, here in Sacramento.
Keeps on ticking, man.
What?
Dude just keeps on ticking. Speaking of keeping on ticking, Willie Nelson, man, just played his 90th birthday at
Hollywood Bowl. 90th birthday, I know. Amazing.
I almost went. It was too last minute, though.
I have to go, Sam, because I got a call at the top of the hour, so we got to say goodnight.
Lots of love.
Thank you so much for a beautiful show, everybody. Thanks for hanging on this long. If you've done so, I hope you've enjoyed our conversation. And Sam, where can they find you again?
They can't. No, Sam at ZenWarriorTraining.com.
And you can find me at Dr. Fred at WelcomeToHumanity.net. I have a couple courses that I've created and a couple books I've written, and I'll be glad to talk to you more about that, any of those. Mostly talking about True Voice, which is the name of this particular podcast, and about helping healers heal so that they can bring their very best work to the forefront and be the kind of healers that they thought they were going to be when they entered the field in the first place. So with that said, thank you so much for being here. Thanks, CJ. Really great show. And we'll catch you guys on the flip side. Bye for now.
Hello, everybody, and I just wanted to thank you for getting through another episode of True Voice with Dr. Fred. Wasn't that great? It is so much fun to interact with people and then interact with my listenership about really finding True Voice and then bringing it forward. I really have never done anything more important than this, and I'm finally aligned with myself by helping others find their True Voice. Let's find your alignment. What do you really want in your life?